Last month, Rita Garman of Danville was sworn in as Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court, the second woman to hold the position. I'm Jim Meadows, and during the first half of Focus today, we'll talk with Justice Garman about her career and her views on judicial matters such as cameras and mics in the courtroom and handling child custody cases. Then, in the second half of Focus, we'll look at the field of emergency management, the folks who direct the cleanup after a big disaster like a tornado. Our guest will be Jack Rozdilsky, a professor of emergency management at Western Illinois University, the only school in the state to offer a degree on the subject. Focus continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Later this hour, we'll be talking to Western Illinois University professor Jack Rozdilsky, and his subject is emergency management, a field that's been in the news all this week following the tornado outbreaks throughout the Midwest last Sunday. But right now, I'm pleased to welcome the Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court. Rita Garman grew up in the Chicago area. She earned her law degree at the University of Iowa, but her legal career started in Danville with the Vermilion County Legal Aid Society and the Vermilion County State's Attorney's Office, as well as private practice. The 69-year-old Garman is a Republican, and she has been an Illinois judge since the age of 30. Over the years, she's moved up from the circuit level to the Illinois Supreme Court. Voters chose to retain Justice Garman in 2012, and in September, her peers in the High Court elected her as their Chief Justice, succeeding Thomas Kilbride. She was sworn in to serve a 3-year term as Chief Justice in October. Justice Garman, welcome to Focus.
Thank you, Jim.
And I'm wondering, being Chief Justice sounds like a great honor and responsibility, but I think a lot of people are just a little fuzzy on the job duties. And so now that you're Chief Justice, as well as a Supreme Court Justice, what extra work do you have to do?
Well, as the Chief Justice, I'm the Chief Spokesman for the court. So that means that I will be giving a number of addresses, speeches, and appearing at functions on behalf of the court, ceremonial functions and educational functions, as the court's representative. And in addition, I'll be shepherding the court's budget through the legislature. So I will be appearing across the street in the Capitol at the, for both the Senate and the House to discuss what kind of funding that the court system needs. So it's really being an administrator. My job, in addition, is to prepare the call of the docket. That means the cases that we hear for each of the 5 terms of the court, and to develop an administrative schedule. Probably half our time is spent on administrative matters in the Supreme Court. So it will be my task to not only bring my ideas to the court, but to solicit the ideas and concerns of my colleagues and make sure that's all brought to the attention of the court in an orderly fashion so that we can talk about matters and decide matters and move forward.
Well, for a position like this, is there someone from whom you draw inspiration, or are there past chief justices in Illinois you hope to emulate?
Well, we have a wonderful tradition of wonderful chief justices. I've served under Moses Harrison and Marianne McMorrow and Robert Thomas and Thomas Fitzgerald and most recently under Thomas Kilbride. And I'm very fortunate that Charles Freeman, who is the senior member of our court, is a former chief justice of the court. So I have a lot of company in that really understand the dynamics and role of the Chief Justice. So I feel I'm very blessed, and I've had a number of people. In addition, my mentor and predecessor, former Chief Justice Ben Miller, has been a strong role model and mentor for me.
Well, we welcome your questions for Chief Justice Rita Garman here on Focus. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Just wondering, what going back now, what was it that first attracted you to this field, to the study of law?
You know, when I was a young woman, no, young girl, actually probably 14, 15 years old, in high school, looking forward to going to college and what I was going to do with my life, I began to focus on a career in the law. And I think what appealed to me the most was the diversity of opportunity in the field. I couldn't have ever imagined that I would one day be a judge, and certainly not Chief Justice, but I thought there were many opportunities. That you could be a litigator, or you could have an office practice. You could work for a corporation. You could do other things. You know, you could be a CPA or whatever you chose to do, and a law degree would help you along the way. So I really, that was really what appealed to me about pursuing the law.
I'm wondering, you're talking about all the opportunities that seem to be available in the legal profession. You went to law school in the 1960s when I suspect you could find more resistance among some male lawyers and law professors to a woman entering the field. How did you handle that?
Well, there was a lot of resistance. I think they were incredulous that a woman would choose to go to law school. People really questioned me. People, contemporaries of mine said to me, "What's a nice girl like you want to do something like that for?" At that time, women were really just emerging in the career field, and women had been really restricted to nursing or teaching or secretarial work. And I thought those were very honorable professions, but I just didn't see that being my path. So my parents, I was very, very, very fortunate. My parents were wonderful people, and they were very encouraging, and they wanted me to follow my dream, and I saw absolutely no reason why I couldn't pursue it.
Were you ever discouraged along the way in your early years by some of the more skeptical reaction that you
had? You know, I wasn't. I remember when I was in law school, and we had one professor that was openly hostile to the women. There were eight of us that started in the College of Law at Iowa in 1965. Five of us ended up graduating. And he would do everything he could to embarrass us and humiliate us. And he told off-color jokes, and he was rude. I just thought in my mind, hey, buddy, you know, mere words are never going to drive me out of here. I'm going to, that's not going to bother me. You can, you know, you show yourself for what you are, and I don't approve of that, but I'm here for the long haul. This is what I want to do. So, you know, something really made me persevere, even when people were doubting and suspect and incredulous and kind of disbelieving.
What was it like when you actually started practicing law in Danville? What sort of reaction or treatment? What was it like working in that situation?
Well, when I first got out of law school and I interviewed for positions, really away from Danville to start with, they didn't know what to do with me. They would say, "Well, you're a nice lady, and you have an excellent academic record, but what would we do with you?" And they would say, "No one wants to talk to a woman. You know, there's no business person is going to come in here and share their business issues with you. They just won't do it." And they just couldn't imagine how I could function in their office setting. So they'd say, "Well, can you make coffee, and can you type, and those kinds of things, and, you know, we don't need somebody just to do research." Well, of course, I wanted to do more than research as a lawyer. So that was really the attitude that persisted. I couldn't even get an interview with the state's attorney here in Danville at the time. And I began my legal career really quite by accident, because I was interviewing, trying to find a position, and the legal aid director had walked out, and it was a one-person office. At that time, legal aid was an operation that was local, and it had a local board of directors funded by the federal government. And they had no one. And one of my husband's partners was chairman of the committee, and he called me up and said, well, you're not doing anything, basically, and which I wasn't. And he said, would you come down and keep the doors of the legal aid office open? We don't know whether it'll close. We'd like to keep it open, and you know, you might be here a week, and you might be here 6 months, and we'll have to see whether we can hire another director, but if you'd come down, we'd, you know, we'd appreciate it. And I said, well, you know, I'm willing to come down and do the work, but I, you know, I've never practiced law. I've certainly never run a law office. What do I know about that? And he said, well, if you do that, we'll help you. And it, you know, turned out that the members of the committee were some of the really most distinguished members of the bar here, and they were true to their word. And I went down to the legal aid office, and I learned quickly that the people that came to legal aid certainly didn't care that I was a woman, and they didn't care that I was young. They were just so happy to see someone that was caring about their concerns and problems and would help them. And so that's how I began to practice law. And the office didn't close. And wouldn't you know, about 10 months later, one day, the state's attorney walked into the legal aid office. And he said he really wanted me to come to work at the state's attorney's office and handle all the family cases, the juveniles, the delinquents, and abuse, neglect, and parentage cases and support cases. So it was a permanent job. So I went to the state's attorney's office and, you know, learned a lot. But really, that's how a lot of women began integrating into the practice of law, because I think they began to see a woman. They could see a woman handling family cases. You know, they might not be able to see a woman doing major felonies or, you know, litigation, but they, you know, people could kind of see that. So, you know, it was a gradual, step that took me along.
We're talking to the Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court, Rita Garman of Danville, here on Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows. If you have a question for Justice Garman, call us. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. The email address, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. I'm wondering that that first work you did for the state's attorney's office in Vermilion County on family issues, I was wondering if that sparked a continuing interest that led to your work in encouraging the creation of the special committee on child custody issues in the court.
It certainly did. You know, when I first began that work in 1969, really at that time, there really wasn't much focus on juvenile law at all. It was kind of, really kind of like the ugly stepchild of the court system. And they often, you know, it seemed like no one really wanted to do it. And so it really evolved during the time that I was in that office, and I don't mean it was just here. That was just kind of the view all over. But you know, as time went forward, it became more important, and we became more enlightened to see that it was important how these children's cases were handled, and it had big implications for them for the rest of their lives and for their families. And so it was. When I first started in the state's attorney's office, Jim, it wasn't uncommon for children to grow up in foster care. And these children had no permanency in their life. They might be in a succession of foster homes, some that were fortunate, maybe lived in one or two homes and had a loving situation. Others didn't have such a good experience. And so, you know, we began to, I think, as a society, realize, well, children shouldn't be subjected to that. They ought to know whether they're going to go back home or be in a permanent, in a permanent home for their own stability and for their own good outlook on life. So I think the whole field began to, gain importance that it should have had. So, you know, you fast forward when I got to the Supreme Court, it was an opportunity to say, you know, my colleague Justice Fitzgerald we came to the table, and he was focused on how we could make the appellate courts faster in handling the juvenile cases. And I said, you know, we need a system-wide review of how we process juvenile cases to make sure that we are handling these cases in a fair manner, of course, but in as expeditious a manner as we can. The court system should not build in delay into these cases, and we ought to focus on them and expedite them. And as a result, we formed this special committee on children's cases, and as a result of that, we developed a whole series of rules we call the 900 series that focuses on moving those cases through the court system so that the permanency of children can be achieved.
Do you think it's made a difference over the years, if you look at how cases are handled now to compared to before that committee was set up?
I think it has. It has certainly moved more cases through and brought cases to finality. And we have, in the Supreme Court, of course, we expedite the cases, too, so that they're not there for, an extended period of time. And we do surveys to make sure that where we are in that. We have mediation in the custody matters now so that we can bring people to the table and get these issues resolved. And I think it's, it continues to be very important.
I'm wondering about one of the biggest changes in Illinois courtrooms recently, and that's the introduction, I guess, just this year by your predecessor, Thomas Kilbride, on an experimental basis of allowing the news media to use cameras and mics in the state's trial courts.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I understand you've spoken in favor of continuing the program as Chief Justice.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this is here to stay, cameras and trial courts?
Oh, I think it's here to stay. I think that this is the wave of the future. I'm not sure it's the wave isn't right here right now, and it probably will continue on. And I think it's important for the transparency of the court system to have the opportunity to see how our cases are handled and see that our judges and prosecutors and defense attorneys and civil attorneys are hardworking people and getting things done, taking it very seriously. It's not so. I think it can be very positive.
The question by skeptics is always whether or not this can become a disruption. I'm wondering what judges have to remember in the way that they run the court, that they run the trial, and making sure that cameras and mics do not become a disruption.
That's true. That's true. And we, of course, we've designed the rules to protect, the children and protect jurors. We don't want jurors to be on camera. Many people are very, very uneasy about that sort of thing. And we want to encourage people, our citizens, to perform their civic responsibilities as jurors, not to discourage it. So we're trying to, and as we are moving along, we're tweaking the programs to make sure that it's successful.
Now, I'm thinking of a case now that is not before the Illinois Supreme Court, and it's not even a case yet, but I think everybody's assuming it will be. And that's the question of pension reform in Illinois.
Mm-hmm. We already do have a pension reform case.
There is a case before the Supreme Court?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Now, that isn't, of course, the proposals that the General Assembly are considering now, but what is this one?
Well, we've heard it's on retirees and on their insurance.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so that's just one.
That's right.
The General Assembly could vote. They could vote in December on another piece of pension reform. It's widely assumed that whatever they pass will be challenged on constitutional grounds, and your court will be asked to rule on it.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I'm wondering is when something that's been discussed like this for so long, it's in the news to such a degree, and I'm just wondering how the justices deal with I don't know if pressure is the right word for describing this, just knowing that this is something that affects a lot of people and you're going to have to make a decision about it.
Sure. Well, you know, in reality, the court only gets the toughest cases. We get the biggest cases. Many of our cases have widespread impact on our citizens. So the court is sensitive to the fact that these cases have big-time implications. And really, every decision that the Supreme Court makes has a ripple effect. It not only affects the parties and the litigation before us, but it's setting precedent. And so it will affect other cases. And that's part of our analysis, is we have to analyze what we're doing in this case and what impact it has on the law. But the judges will take a very objective view, we'll look at the legislation as it is as it is passed. We'll hear the arguments of the parties, and we'll research the law, and we'll make a considered decision on the case.
My understanding that the way this system is set up is that the court system's own pensions, the justices and the judges' own pensions, are not involved in these cases.
Mm-hmm.
Who does rule on those pensions? If any questions come up,
we would have to rule on them. What's called the rule of necessity, which means that and on those cases, even though we might have some interest in it, we still have a responsibility to decide those cases, to set aside personal interest and decide the cases on the law.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's part of our responsibility and duty. I mean, we can't dodge a case. We certainly wouldn't dodge a case because it's a tough case, because they're all tough cases.
So the General Assembly may be reluctant to send that sort of case to you, but if it comes, you're ready, huh?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We stand ready to decide and hear those cases that are properly brought to the court. And, we're ready for the challenge. That's part of the responsibilities of our court.
I have an email in from Gary, and he's asking, about the larger question is how the courts treat DUI cases. And in his observation, at least as he sees it, Gary says, it seems to take five or more DUI incidents before a substantial penalty such as jail time is imposed. He's asking the question, are we tough enough in Illinois on DUI situations? He writes, I would note that in 1981, I was in southern Norway in a rental car. After visiting a Norwegian friend and having two drinks, the friend insisted that I not drive the car back to my hotel. Instead, I walked 2 miles along a country road and retrieved the rental car the next morning. Mm-hmm. I guess that's suggesting that in Norway, perhaps they're tougher on DUI cases, on possible intoxication of motorists than they are in the U.S. or in Illinois.
Well, there are places in the world where they have zero tolerance, and that, as your listener indicated, there are places where if you drink alcohol, you cannot drive a vehicle.
Not even a little bit of alcohol in blood.
Not even a little bit. Our legislative branch hasn't chosen to make that decision or to take the law there. And so we decide the cases according to what the current law is. And I would also say, that's an area of the law that in my years of experience on the bench has changed dramatically. When I first got into this business, if a person could have multiple DUIs and not served any kind of jail time. But now the laws are tougher. It's designed so that people not supposed to get supervision more on a DUI more than one time. And if they have multiple DUIs, they've been up the penalties have been upgraded to make felonies of some of these offenses. So I think our legislature has responded to the views of the public to upgrade and make more serious these kinds of offenses. And of course, we see the havoc that's wrought on the public by people's misuse of drugs and alcohol.
Would you disagree then with Jack's observation, at least in his view, that it takes five or more cases of DUI against a person for jail time to be given?
No, I don't agree with I can't remember a case that I've seen like that. Our courts in our lower courts, our circuit courts, are applying the law, and the appellate court's looking at those things carefully. So, I think that it's a part of the system. The state's attorney is the person that brings the charges and prosecutes the cases. But I know that people take those cases very seriously.
Well, Justice Garmon, my questions could go on, but I know your time is limited. Rita Garmon is beginning a 3-year term as Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court. Thank you for being our guest on Focus today.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to talk about the field of emergency management, the folks who run the cleanup operations after a disaster, such as last Sunday's tornado outbreak. This is Focus on WILL. Welcome back to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Last Sunday's multi-state outbreak of tornadoes has meant a lot of heartbreak and disruption for the victims who have lost their homes and other properties. And it's meant a lot of work for people in the field of emergency management. They are the folks who come out to a community like Gifford or Washington to coordinate the cleanup and get things started on the longer, more complicated job of rebuilding. You may wonder how people get jobs in the field of emergency management. Is it something you can major in at college? Well, actually, you can, at least in a few places around the country. And Western Illinois University in Macomb happens to be the only school in Illinois to offer an emergency management degree program. And for this part of Focus, we're going to talk with one of their professors. Jack Rozdilski is an assistant professor in the emergency management program at WIU. And Jack and I have met before as an undergraduate in Bradley University in Peoria. Jack also worked part-time at Bradley's public radio station, WCBU, in the newsroom where I was working at the time. Jack went on to get master's and doctoral degrees at other schools, but I am sure his early experience in our newsroom gave him insight in how to manage chaotic situations. Professor Rozdilski, welcome to Focus.
Jim, I'm very pleased to talk to you again, and thank you for taking the time and interest on your radio program to consider the recent disasters in Illinois.
Well, the other day on this program, I was talking with the former mayor of Ogden. It's a town in Champaign County. They were hit badly by a tornado in 1996. And he talked about, and you could still hear it in his voice, he was just revisiting the emotions he felt as he walked through the downtown of Ogden and saw all the destruction around him. And then the relief he felt when the emergency management crews showed up with a plan of action ready to be implemented. Because at that point, here he was the mayor of this town, and he had no idea where to start with all the damage that had done. How do you design a plan? How are plans laid out by emergency managers for situations like this?
Jim, when we look at generally emergency management offices, and I guess what I'd be referring to here would be emergency management offices, both at county government level and perhaps in some places even at city government levels in the public sector. Emergency in peacetime or times when disasters are not happening, emergency managers work on the phase of disaster management, which is called preparedness. And one of the many activities they engage in during the preparedness phase would be to write something that we call by an acronym of an EOP, an emergency operations plan. And what the emergency operation plan does is it lays out a schematic. If and when a disaster does occur, it sets kind of a game plan in place, which gives a general guidance and an outline of instructions and strategies so that the emergency management community can spring into action literally within minutes after a disaster striking.
Okay. By the way, we welcome your questions for Jack Rostilsky about emergency management. The phone number, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. I gather these EOPs, the Emergency Operational Plans, they have to consider a lot of different situations. We're all thinking about tornadoes right now, but a lot of other bad things can happen that constitute an emergency.
Yes, we can have disasters primarily from three different sources of origin. Of course, the natural disasters we're very familiar with in Illinois. Situations like tornadoes, flooding, earthquakes are all possible in the state. We also have what I would categorize as technological disasters. Disasters originating from some type of technology, either an accident, something breaking down, some piece of technology breaking. That can range from anything from a factory explosion, nuclear power plant meltdowns, oil spills, such as what we saw with the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, pipeline breaks, airplane crashes, issues with technology. And the third type of origin of disasters we can have is disasters originating from social causes, the behaviors or misbehaviors of people. That can include issues related to terrorism. That can include school shootings, civil disturbances, etc. So disasters can come to us in many shapes and sizes.
Do you have a sort of outline or script ready for different situations, which, of course, can be varied by the immediate situation, but just giving an idea of what to do first and what things to remember?
Yes, and that's generally what we're talking about, the emergency operation plan would do. There are certain commonalities to response to any disaster that would be included in an emergency operation plan. But then many, depending on where you are in the state, an emergency operation plan in the Chicago area would have many different threats, perhaps, than an emergency operation plan in the far southern part of the state. So special chapters of the plan or annexes can be written based on the type of matrix of hazards faced in any specific jurisdiction.
Now, I understand you've been out to some tornado-ravaged areas this week, such as Washington and Tazewell County, that was the place that was very badly hit.
Yes. On Wednesday of this week, I accompanied a small advance team of myself and students to Tazewell County. We spent some time working with the Tazewell County Emergency Management Agency. We provided some assistance to their Emergency Operations Center in terms of planning and helping them staff various positions in incident command on Wednesday. We also had a very brief chance to see what was happening in Washington, and Jim, portions of Washington look like they have been through a blunder. It's a very sad situation. And I like to say we are, right now, our thoughts should be going out to, number one, the tornado victims in many portions of this state. And I would also add, number two, the many men and women who are first responders and emergency managers who have been working around the clock, essentially, since the morning on Sunday.
I'm wondering what it's like for these emergency workers when a disaster strikes. They're really, you know, there's really no rest for them. And I'm wondering, thinking back to what Jim Gilliland, that former mayor of Ogden, and about his reaction to emergency workers, I'm wondering if there's a lot of pressure on them to just really be able to do everything, because there's just so much that's needed to be done and so much hope that people may pin on them.
There's a lot of pressure put on the men and woman of emergency management. And I think what I would stress here, we as society have many expectations that when a disaster occurs, there will be someone there to help us, someone there to back us up, more or less the government will be there to rescue you. That will eventually happen, but we can't necessarily count on that unless we provide support to the emergency management community year-round in terms of personnel, equipment, facilities. These types of assets need to exist before the disaster to allow a response to take place during a disaster. It's not like you just have a light switch. You can turn it on and you have emergency managers showing up after the disaster to help out. It's a year-round activity and visible most of the year, except for the very short times in which we have a serious disaster. This is in the spotlight.
And that is something to consider. I know, just looking back and reviewing my own memories, my mental picture of what tornado damage in Illinois might be on any particular incident was, say, a string of scattered damage done to various houses, and I wasn't really thinking of the large degree of damage done in places like Washington or Gifford here in Champaign County or in Ogden back in the 1990s. And is it a challenge to remind the people who make the decisions that this thing is, these sort of things are always possible?
Yes, Jim, we look at, for example, the fiscal situations in public government in the state of Illinois. Very challenging in this day and age. And one of the things I've looked at in detail was one of the last large tornadoes to hit the state of Illinois. That was in February of 2012 in Harrisburg, Illinois. We had a circumstance of an EF4 tornado with wind speeds estimated at about 185 miles an hour hitting Saline County and Harrisburg, Illinois, killing 8 persons and damaging 300 homes. And I've been looking at their response and recovery, and one of the things I'm finding is the importance of emergency management authorities and offices having the proper resources in place to manage these types of disasters.
And how do things look at that? And I'm thinking, you know, that's really a fairly recent disaster. How have the budgets been for emergency management in this state in the last few years, especially considering all the problems the state is having?
I could speak in generalized terms, but the reductions in emergency, the reduction in funding in the emergency management community has been drastic since the days immediately after the tragic September 11th events.
So I would think funding really went up after 9/11.
Funding really went up after 9/11, but then as the years passed after 9/11, a lot of that funding began to disappear and go toward other things.
We're talking with Jack Rozdilski. He's an assistant professor who specializes in emergency management at Western Illinois University. Your questions or comments welcome at 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. In the situation of the Harrisburg tornado, I'm wondering, as you look back on that, because time has passed, I know that really the news coverage window, the stuff that people will see on TV, is just in the first days and weeks after a disaster. What sort of work lies ahead as time goes on? What sort of and how challenging is it to get that sort of rebuilding done when a disaster strikes?
For example, right now Harrisburg is in week 90 of its recovery. The specific time and date of that storm was February 29, Leap Day 2012. The EF4 tornado hit town around 5 a.m. So currently in week 90, The town is still rebuilding. They've made a lot of progress, but the rebuilding is still active. There are many ways in which people in Harrisburg are still coping with the aftermath of the disaster. I think in talking to people in Harrisburg and observing what has been happening, we can look at two factors. There is the physical reconstruction after disasters, which is by no means easy. It's complicated, but in comparison to social reconstruction of communities, the physical reconstruction of a community, meaning putting back homes and businesses, infrastructure, is relatively easy as compared to long-term social recovery.
And, you know, you always hear, we've been hearing about communities really banding together to try to rebuild in the face of these disasters. But what sort of problems do they face over the long term?
Over the long term, I think it's maintaining attention and momentum to keep recovering in the community. And I think we've observed from Harrisburg, the disaster allowed the community to really look inward at itself. And by looking inward at itself in the time of crisis, Harrisburg and Saline County were able to determine what strengths resided in the community. And they were, again, able to use those strengths to begin to rebuild, engage in a process to perhaps come back as a stronger community. And something that really rose to the forefront, at least to Harrisburg, was the church, community churches and faith-based organizations have really played a key role in helping Harrisburg through its recovery.
And that simply being able to give emotional and spiritual support, but is there also some sort of organizational support that they can give to various efforts in the town?
No, yes. I mean, even beyond that type of spiritual and emotional support, direct practical support to the community in terms of creating or facilitating specific types of long-term aid to the community, because right now it's too early to tell what's happening with the recent disasters such as Gifford and Washington. But in Harrisburg, after the disaster happened, they did not receive a federal disaster declaration. So the community was in many ways on its own working through the recovery, and they're doing a very good job doing what they can with their limited resources available.
Mm-hmm. Wanted to ask you also, we think about the urban areas, about what happens in the town, because that's where so many buildings are. What happens in the case, when talking about tornadoes, to rural areas? Is there damage there that doesn't usually come to mind to people?
Yeah, and I think I appreciate, Jim, you bringing that up, because when we look at outside of maybe the Chicago metropolitan area, we have many small cities and villages throughout western, central, eastern, and southern Illinois, which are geographically located in agricultural areas. And when you have a wind of 180 to 200 miles an hour go through a small city, everything goes up, but a lot of it has to come down somewhere. And where that debris comes down would be in farmlands along the path of the tornado. And we look at farmlands. The farmland is essentially the farmer's site of work. It's their site of production. It's their site of income. And when we see the pictures on television, we see a lot of pictures of the cities and neighborhoods destroyed, as we should. It's very important to see those places and the impact, and it's very important to help cities in their recovery. But at the same time, we should not ignore issues like how do we deal with massive amounts of debris spread over large areas of farmland. That also needs to be considered and cleaned up.
And let's talk a little bit more about the debris question, because I think for people who live in urban areas, we drive by farm fields, we take them for granted. But one thing a tornado does, you know, if it touches down in a farm field, it'll drop the debris, some of the debris it's carrying.
Mm-hmm.
Right then, what sort of things show up in a farm field after a tornado strike?
Pieces of everything that were in the cities that were destroyed. Okay. And I mean everything from pieces of roofs of houses to something small like a doorknob to people's personal items to unidentified small pieces of wood and metal.
It's not something you can easily run a plow over, I take it.
Yeah, and if we look at modern farming equipment, combines and so forth, these are complicated machines which are quite a substantial investment to the farmer. And sucking a piece of debris through a machine, messing up the mechanisms, can be quite costly and expensive to farm operations. It's something that we like to try to avoid.
What do farmers have to do? I mean, are they pretty much left to the sifting through, say, damaged fields by hand to get this stuff out?
Well, I could speak to what happened in the Harrisburg and Saline County area after the tornado. And through the Saline County Emergency Management Agency, in cooperation with various voluntary organizations, worked to organize an effort which was a farmland debris removal effort, where volunteers from the Future Farmers of America statewide organization literally walked the fields outside of Harrisburg for the 7 days after the tornado, picking up pieces of debris.
Now, in your visit to Tazewell County this week, did you see signs that sort of work may be necessary there? There's certainly a good bit of agriculture in Tazewell County.
It may be necessary, but I'd be hesitant to speculate. I was not in a situation to have been able to do a full damage assessment of all areas impacted, but it would be, I think, reasonable for us to consider that such a situation may be something to keep in mind, as it may definitely be possible in areas like Tazewell and Woodford County.
And certainly with the tornado strikes we had last Sunday over such a large area,
yes,
this must be a situation that farmers in a lot of places may be facing.
And even if we think about the statewide emergency management situation, we can go from the Chicago Bears game where the game was halted. Spectators had to evacuate to shelter when the storms passed overhead, all the way down to Brookport, as far south as you can go in Illinois. We have cities from north to south dealing with various aspects of the tornado, and then large areas in between where debris is scattered. So we are looking at recovery processes that are going to be taking years in some places to sort this out.
I'm wondering, just as individuals, whether or not we're working in emergency management, are there things that people can do just in terms of common sense prevention and preparation to be as ready as possible for the sort of emergencies like tornadoes, hazardous waste spills, whatever?
I would recommend if you can do one thing, that one thing to do would be to make sure that you have a weather radio. A weather radio is a device which receives forecast and weather information from National Weather Service forecast offices. And in event of a severe weather situation, the weather radio is actually designed to set off an alarm to alert you ahead of time that severe weather is approaching. In addition, if there are any other types of civil emergencies where authorities need to make contact with citizens immediately, the weather radio can also trigger an alarm for other types of disasters. So that's a simple step citizens can take to both be more prepared and be aware when areas they are living in may potentially be under threat.
Is there anything that the average person should make it a point to know about the plans that their community has in place for emergency operations?
Yes. What the average person should know about this, that there are plans in the communities to take action, but depending on the extent of the disaster in any specific community, you may not be receiving aid instantly. We think of during peacetime, we call 911, and we expect a response in 7 to 11 minutes from first responders. During the time of a disaster, it may take some time to get to everybody. So I would recommend that households have on hand a disaster supplies kit or a 72-hour kit with some food, water, and basic supplies. In the event they're in a disaster, they have something to fall back on for at least a few hours or perhaps a few days.
Well, Jack, thank you very much. We've been talking with Jack Rozdilsky, Assistant Professor of Emergency Management at Western Illinois University. That is the only school in Illinois where you can get a degree in emergency management. Professor Rozdilsky, thank you for joining us on Focus today.
Thank you, Jim.
Welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. We're likely the first result in your search engine under WILL Focus. Today's show produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. Sari Lesk is our intern, helping with production and research. Monday on Focus, we'll hear an archive broadcast discussing the future of AM radio. AM radio just like this station, WILL AM 580. Our guests, FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai and Michael Harrison of Talkers Magazine, a magazine devoted to talk radio. That's coming up on Monday's program. Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. You can hear us over the air on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. This is Focus on WILL.